Athletics Tuesday National College Football Podcast, hosted by yours truly, Nicole Auerbach, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Chris Vanini, as we discuss the biggest stories in college sports in an hour or less, which is what we do every week. And, you know, I think that we have to start with the weirdest and biggest story in college football this week so far, which is whatever happened to Deion Sanders before, during, and after his first game as the head coach at Jackson State. I'm still extremely confused what did or didn't happen.
Yeah, well, first off, we've got football this spring, FCS football, and in one of the most one of the biggest headlines of that is Deion Sanders taking over as the head coach of Jackson State. And a lot of stuff has happened since Deion took over. They've signed a lot of good players. They played their first game against a one-win NAIA team. I think it was Edward Waters was the name. They won 50-something to nothing. It was a blowout and all that. But Deion starts his press conference by saying some stuff was stolen out of his office or something, and was upset that, you know, you get this win and he can't call his mom, can't call his family or whatever. So that sucks to have stuff stolen from you. But then Jackson State comes out and says, no, it wasn't stolen. It was misplaced. We found it. Okay, that was weird. And then Deion Sanders comes back and says, no, something was stolen, and my assistant saw someone trying to steal it. Then Jackson State releases a statement saying things were taken but were briefly found and brought back, and everything's fine. So just a strange start to the Deion Sanders era at Jackson State. I don't know. What did you make of it?
Well, you know, I guess part of the reason you hire him is for all attention. Any and all attention, good, bad, and in between. But this seems like a really bad thing that we are talking about who to trust regarding whether or not something was stolen, because we don't know if we can trust the school. We also don't know if we can trust Deion Sanders' version of the events. And we're not even talking about the game itself, which, like you said, I mean, it would absolutely suck to have stuff stolen, for sure. Does it need to be the main takeaway of the press conference? Probably not.
And that's what Jackson State said. In their final statement, they said they didn't want it to take away from the win. Well, too late for that.
Well,
yeah.
Yes. Too late. And also, again, you hired someone you can't really control. Like, that is part of the deal. That
they called him Coach Prime in the press release. They called him Coach Prime in the press release. So I think we know kind of who has the power here.
Yes. So obviously this is one of the big storylines of the spring season. I think another thing in general was, you know, were people going to watch? You know, like, I think there's this curiosity about a spring FCS season. We've seen interest in recent years with the Alliance and XFL and kind of this opening in the spring. I would say that so far, I would say probably not, based on the fact that these games all required a little bit of effort to get to go to ESPN Plus. What is your sense of that? Do you think there's any kind of spotlight opportunity for FCS teams this spring?
Yeah, I think a lot of people didn't realize when they knew we were getting a spring football season that almost all of that is streaming. It's almost entirely on ESPN Plus or Flow Football or Pluto TV. The majority of it is on ESPN Plus. So unless you have ESPN Plus, it's difficult to watch unless you are in one of those home markets and get the local TV. So I don't know what the reaction is going to be to a spring FCS season. I mean, I think coaches are going to be watching it for some potential transfers that they may want to go after in the future. And you know, once we get to the playoffs, because FCS has a real playoff with 16 teams this year instead of the normal 24, that'll be on linear TV. A couple of Jackson State games are too.
So they're going to have a full-on playoff. Like, this is a full season.
Yes. It's 16 instead of the normal 24, 10 automatic bids, 6 at-larges, no buys, which is what they normally would do. So that's the plan. Because there's about like 90-ish of the 127 teams in FCS that are playing.
Okay. Because you also did a primer as well. So if anyone is trying to get into FCS football, you can find that on The Athletic. Scott Dockerman also did, you know, preview content. I wrote about two rivals who decided to play in the fall, SEMO and Southern Illinois. And now they're having their respective spring seasons. I wrote about Austin Peay, which opened the 2020 season, basically showed people that you could play college football in the pandemic.
Yeah, I remember that game. First game.
Big deal, August 29th. So they basically have the longest season, or at least the longest regular season out of anyone, because...
Got to be the longest season in history, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And
who plays from August to April?
To April. And you know, I mean, they had a coaching change in the middle of it. They had three tough losses in the fall, but they were able to bring in almost $1 million for the athletic department. And it was just really interesting because we saw, it's like, again, for people who maybe forgot these spring seasons were happening, it's like you're connecting the dots of there were teams that decided to play a couple games and decided to keep their bye games or add some, or like Central Arkansas tried to fill as many games as possible. And then we head into this season. What does that mean? There were teams that opted out. There have been players who opt out, players who want to be drafted who are not going to play in the spring, maybe some that will. So it's an interesting time period. And then you got to think about, like, these teams are also then going to play in the fall again. So how do you manage that? It's pretty fascinating because, again, like when we were talking about all this stuff last summer, the idea of a spring season, the idea of a winter season is pretty different than when it actually gets around and gets here, because they're basically starting the season. A lot of places were frozen and they've been practicing in like sub-zero temperatures to have a spring, quote unquote, spring season. So it's going to be interesting these next, what, 6-8 weeks. Most of these conferences are playing 6 or 8 game schedules.
Yeah, it's a mix of, well, I think some might actually be down to 4, but it's 6 to 8. Some have non-conference games. Some have played those already. It's weird. Everybody's doing something different. It's just like we saw in FBS, and everybody's not even starting at the same time. And yeah, it's like you said, some teams played only in the fall. Some played a few in the fall and in the spring. Some played only in the spring. Some are playing a lot in the spring and are going to play perhaps as many as 20 or more games in the entire calendar year of 2020 when you think about that. So some schools opted out. They didn't want to put that much on their players, and that includes teams like Montana State, who are top 10 teams, who decided not to play this spring and want to focus more on fall 2021. So everybody's doing it differently. You know, this is college sports where there's no, you know, set guideline that everybody follows. Everybody kind of does their own thing, as we saw in the fall. And that's continuing again with the FCS in the spring.
So what is realistic to expect out of Deion Sanders at Jackson State?
Well, I don't expect much this first year because, you know, he's brought a lot of good players in, a lot of transfers and recruits and whatnot, but they're not eligible for the spring. They can't play until the fall. So he's taken over a team that was, I think, 4-8 in 2019. So that they were not a great team. But, you know, first one, it's a win. Again, it was an NAIA team. They were going to win big, but they seem to have a quarterback in Jalen Jones, Florida transfer. So we'll see. It also helps that Alcorn State, the defending SWAC champion, opted out like 2 weeks ago at the last second, decided to opt out of a spring season. That means that's one fewer tough opponent on the schedule. It counts as a forfeit. So Jackson State's got that one in the bag too. So yeah, I mean, we know with Deion that everything's going to be a show, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, there's a lot of attention on Jackson State, a lot of attention on HBCUs, and they're getting a lot of players because of it. So off we go.
Yeah, and again, if anyone wants other FCS preview stuff, Chris wrote about it, Scott Dockerman wrote about it, Ari Wasserman wrote about Deion and this trend of, you know, elite players, 4-star type players going to HBCU. So you can check all of that out on The Athletic. And also this week, Chris, you know, it's sort of finally we've reached the end of the coaching carousel. And I know you wrote this great piece kind of breaking down the lessons learned from it. And since it's, you know, there's not a ton of news floating around, I do think it's worth taking some time and reflecting on that. Let's start with, what was your main takeaway from 2020, 2021 hiring and firing in college football?
It's that there is always money to buy out a coach if you really want to find it. You and I did a story in April, early on in the pandemic, about the financial challenges that were coming up ahead of affecting college sports. And one of the ADs told us, you know, I think the days of buying out coaches like Drunken Sailors are gone. Well, not quite. Gus Malzahn gets $21 million guaranteed from Auburn. Steve Sarkisian and his staff are getting $25 million from Texas. I'm sorry, Tom Herman and his staff are getting $25 million from Texas. South Carolina paid Will Muschamp $13 million to go away. Kevin Sumlin got $7.5 million from Arizona. And some of these schools laid off staff, like Texas and Arizona furloughed people. They laid off staff, still found the money to buy out a coach, because in the end, that's the most important thing. And I think something an agent told us at the time turned out to be true, which was it was going to show just how important football is, because football is the one that makes all the money. And I think that's it's exactly what we saw with places like Tennessee and Texas and South Carolina and everything going, is that no matter what's going on, even if it's a raging pandemic and you're running out of money, there's always money to buy out a coach.
And I mean, the corollary of this appears to be there are drunken sailors in college football still. We're worried they might not be existing. I think that that is one of the main takeaways too. And, you know, it honestly feels like the college basketball audience is learning that lesson now too, because Jim Christian gets let go at BC. And, you know, some of the reaction from media and fans is, how could they do this in a pandemic? And it's a year into it. And did we not just see all the changes that were made in football and the money that was thrown around? I mean, Boston College basketball is not going to be the only basketball program that decides that that is important enough to make a change. And I just think that, you know, we weren't the only ones, and the people we talked to weren't the only ones who were hopeful that this would kind of be a reset on the spending. And yet, you know, I think you're always going to be able to find boosters. It's wild to me, because the one thing I was for sure certain about was that something like Willie Taggart wouldn't happen. $20 million buyout. And then literally it gets eclipsed. So I understand that this is donors' money, you know, a popular refrain to pointing any of this out, that this is happening while there's cuts in athletic departments or sports being cut, is you can't stop people from spending their own money where they want to do it. But I think the issue that people have typically is that, you know, if these are people who really care about their athletics and they're spending money and they want to donate and they want to be the best, that money could be funneled elsewhere if they wanted to commit to their athletic department. You know, if they wanted to save sports, if they wanted to save jobs, and not just cover the cost of a football coach to not coach there. I feel like that's missing sometimes in the conversation, even though it is other people's money and these are donors who are deciding to cover the costs. It's also still the school and the athletic director who, you know, got outmatched by an agent or whatever it was on the front end, made an extension that they shouldn't have, whatever it was, that is putting them on the hook for this much money in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, you can't tell people where they want to spend money. They'd much rather put their money on a football building that has their name on it than, you know, save the swimming team or something like that.
Well, and really? What a weird concept.
It's why, you know, it's why it comes around in this topic of name, image, likeness, is that, like, you know, is that going to change where money goes? Are boosters more likely going to do some sort of sponsorship with a player at the local car dealership or something like that? We don't know. It's just, we know that money is going everywhere in college sports except directly to the players. And it's been that way forever, but it's been so much more pronounced over the last 20 years. I mean, it was 2009. It was the first time we had a $1 million assistant coach. That was Monty Kiffin at Tennessee. Now we've got Texas has three $1 million assistant coaches. We've got assistant coaches making $2 million. We've got Gus Malzahn getting $21 million to not coach. It's just crazy, and it's not slowing down.
No, it's not. And that brings us to the second point on your takeaways from the cycle is, despite the fact that this isn't slowing down, despite the fact that other people are willing to pony up the money for these buyouts, one school decided to go a different route and it almost assuredly backfired. So what the heck happened with Tennessee?
Okay, I don't feel like we're talking enough about Tennessee and how insane the situation
was. It was insane.
So that's the one spot where it looks like they couldn't get the boosters to pull up the money. It was going to cost about $13 million to get rid of Jeremy Pruitt. Same amount South Carolina pulled together for Will Muschamp. All because Jeremy Pruitt got a completely unnecessary contract extension in September. So as a result, instead of they couldn't get the money to buy him out, they end up starting an internal investigation into potential recruiting violations, apparently find them, and fire Pruitt for so they don't have to pay any buyout. They then go and hire Danny White, the AD, Josh Heupel, the coach at UCF. They have to buy them out for $6 million just for the right to hire them. And then Jeremy Pruitt's probably going to sue. They're probably going to settle. So you're probably spending the same amount of money and you've torpedoed yourself by inviting the NCAA to penalize you for all these things that you found. It's absolutely insane what Tennessee did.
And you're paying your new coach and his whole new staff.
Yes, and you might have to buy out Kevin Steele, who you hired
and made the interim head coach for like 2 weeks.
Yeah, and might have to pay him like $500,000.
And so to your point about the NCAA violations too, because that was hanging over you, you also had to have longer contracts or more security.
Yeah, Josh Heupel was not your number one choice, as much as Danny White likes to say it. There were other coaches you'd rather have who did not want to step into that situation.
Literally none of this makes any sense.
It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen in a coaching change, to essentially torpedo your program and then all because of a bad contract extension, and then you're probably not going to save any money anyway. It's absolutely crazy.
Is there any positives from that situation? Like, now I would say like one silver lining is they have an athletic director who's actually an athletic director now.
Yes. Danny White is a very good AD. I think he was a terrific hire by them. You know, Philip Fulmer as the AD was not working. That and Fulmer only took over because of the whole mess after the Schiano situation. They've got a guy who knows how to run an athletic department and do it very well, and that's Danny White. Outside of that, you know, Josh Heupel's got a pretty secure next couple of years. That's for sure. A guy who UCF fans were starting to kind of itch for a coaching change instead moves up to an SEC job. We get paid more money, has a longer contract. So, you know, good for Josh Heupel.
A couple of your other takeaways to me seem very tied together. One is about retreads and about people kind of going back to people who have head coaching experience, maybe got fired somewhere, whatever it is, but giving people another chance. And then also a lack of diversity in the hires. To me, those things go hand in hand. Did either of those surprise you in this cycle?
It did. I was surprised how many, I guess you call them retreads, there were. And two of them were made by the same AD. Terry Mahajer hired Butch Jones at Arkansas State. Then he hires
Gus Malzahn
at UCF. So you, 9 of the 15 coaching changes in this cycle, 9 of them had previous head coaching experience. There's also Josh Heupel, Will Hall, Brian Harsin, Steve Sarkisian, and Terry Bowden. This was not the year where you hire the up-and-coming coordinator, which kind of surprised me. Instead, most people went with someone who's done it before and basically wants to prove that they still got it. You know, Brett Bielema at Illinois being another one.
Would there be any reason that that would be sort of contagious? Like, why would that be? Would the fact that some of the early hires did that inspire others? Like, I'm just a little confused because you would think this would be the opportunity to hire an up-and-coming guy at a discount while you're still, you know, working through your financial. Again, maybe finances did not matter, which we thought and people hoped that they would. So maybe that's the overall takeaway, but
Yeah, I think they depend on the situation. I mean, Brett Bielema at Illinois, he's coached in the Big Ten. He had success in the Big Ten. I get it. Terry Bowden at ULM, he's a guy who's taken programs from nothing and built them into something. I get it. Steve Sarkisian just had one of the best, maybe the best offense in college football history. You know, it makes sense why he would get another job. Some of the other ones were surprising. You know, Brian Harsin to Auburn was surprising. He's never coached in the SEC before. Josh Heupel, as we mentioned, was surprising, but that was kind of a weird situation. So it's they're all kind of unique spots. I think most notably is the head coaches who didn't get the jobs. I mean, your Billy Napiers, your Jamie Chadwells, your Lance Leipolds, your Hugh Freeze's. Those guys are all Luke Fickell, I guess, even though he can be picky. But there's a lot of really good group of five head coaches who I think will make for a very deep pool the next time around. I think a lot of these schools didn't want to pay another buyout to hire another coach. I mean, Tennessee did, but you don't want to necessarily pay another million or so to buy out another coach after you paid millions to buy out your current coach. So I'm sure money played a role in that as well.
Yeah, and then, you know, just again, the last takeaway that I want to hit on is about the NFL, because as we both have made fun of quite a bit, there were a lot of anonymous quotes from a lot of people saying that all these college coaches can't handle the name, image, and likeness reform. They don't like the transfer trends, and they're going to go to the NFL where the players are paid, by the way, but also more important than the coaches. So, like, was that real, that college coaches were going to look at NFL opportunities, but it just didn't happen, or it was always just kind of like a little bit of bluster, in your opinion?
I think they were letting off a bit of steam. I mean, I think it's pretty real. I mean, I think Dan Mullen was pretty interested in the NFL, but it doesn't appear that there was a ton of interest back. Pat Fitzgerald, Matt Campbell, Lincoln Riley, guys who have gotten that interest before. And instead of getting an NFL job, Pat Fitzgerald has a 10-year contract at Northwestern. So, you know, I think it's a lot of coaches are frustrated that things are changing in their sport. And so they, you know, they say, hey, the idea of going to the NFL where you don't have to recruit, you know, you have an off season, it's appealing. It is. It really is appealing. But warnings like that are nothing new. I mean, Kirby Smart, way back in 2015 when he was at Alabama, said back then that every coach he knew was looking to go to the NFL because recruiting had just become too much of a grind. And it is. It really is an incredible grind that they have to work through 24/7. But, you know, in the 5-6 years since then, there's been no mass exodus to the NFL. The coaches adjust. They adjust to the changes because the money's good for the most part. If you're in the Power Five, the money's good. And you know, they just adjust to how the game changes, and I'm sure that's the same thing that's going to happen with transfer rules and name, image, likeness. They're going to complain about a lot of it, but in the end, they'll deal with it.
Yeah, and I'll add too. I mean, you know, you're already seeing, you know, kind of people be strategic with this. I mean, earlier on Monday, you had Jack Swarbrick, the athletic director at Notre Dame, saying, "Hey, we're not going to participate in the EA Sports College Football video game until our athletes would get compensated for it," right? Like, that is smart. That is adjusting to the times, understanding what is coming, and, you know, at least getting on the right side of history on it a little bit, at least, you know, kind of like speaking, you know, kind of pointing out to your potential recruits and your current student athletes that, like, you're going to get your cut when this is happening. Like, we're going to make sure that you can. I mean, like, I think that people are getting smarter. You also have, you know, right now, the Coaches Association, Rules Committee, like, everyone's kind of looking at how to have better work-life balance with recruiting. Like, there's going to be elements of virtual recruiting that get built into the calendar because they do want that. So, like, it's interesting that some of those aspects are going to be addressed, or at least, you know, if you're going to be smart and be a little proactive on stuff, you can address some of them yourself. So I'm definitely curious to see what happens with that, especially just as we don't know what the name, image, and likeness rules and laws will be at this point. But, you know, it's happening, it's here to stay, and I do think that, you know, every couple of years there's always something. It's like, oh, you know, they're gonna legalize gambling, and then, you know, oh, like, coaches don't want to deal with it, fans will hate it, satellite camps, yeah, like, this will be the end of, and then we all move on, we all adjust, we all get used to it. So I think it will be some of that as well.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. LinkedIn knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats, it might not have the time or resources to hire. LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and it's time you join that number. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/CFB23. That's linkedin.com/CFB and the numbers 23 to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, I think that right now, you know, we're going to, in Power Hour, we're going to, you know, talk more about basketball as we move forward too, because, you know, actually the biggest story here is, you know, 3 weeks from this past Sunday is Selection Sunday. Like, we're actually going to get that this year. This is, not only is it a big deal, you know, we're talking about like why people might have been smarter with their money because they didn't get the money from the tournament last year, but this is a big deal for the return of normalcy. I mean, this was the first major event that got disrupted, that we lost. What does it mean for you to kind of be thinking about March Madness around the corner?
Two things. One of which is the NCAA desperately needs this tournament to happen.
Yes.
And to go off. You know, obviously it's been well reported how much money they lost on that and the lack of various insurance that they had. They needed to happen. Now they're going to allow some fans in as well. They're taking every step possible to make sure this goes off well, which is good. Obviously, there was a lot of college basketball players from the last season who we didn't get to see them in their final NCAA tournament run. And that just really kind of sucked. And so you want to give that to the kids this year, but the finances matter as well. And then the other part is, yeah, like you said, that, like, March 11th, 12th-ish, the Rudy Gobert positive test and the NCAA tournament cancellation in the NBA, that whole thing, that was, like, the moment it hit everybody, I think. You know, there had been talk for weeks about it. It was really, whoa, the NCAA tournament is not happening. That was the bomb that really, I think, set everything off in the sports world.
Yeah, and so that's why I think having it and having it at the right time of year on time, like, these are things that are going to be really appreciated. I think people don't, you know, we always talked about how, you know, those first, I would say the first 4 days of the tournament are like the best 4 days of sports on the calendar, and to not have it and then to not have live sports, right? Like, it was, it made us appreciate things in a different way. And so I think, you know, for as challenging at times that it's been to get into this college basketball season, because there've been so many disruptions with COVID, and they basically, I mean, I think basketball is the sport that invented, like, the term the pause, because they're like, oh, they're coming out of a pause. I don't think we talked about that in football. You know, it's starting to really ramp up. Like, I'm starting to feel it. I felt like watching Michigan Ohio State on Sunday felt like, okay, this feels like March. Like, this felt like a, you know, Final Four type caliber game, even without the fans there. Like, it just, it had that energy, and it's starting to get me excited for the tournament, because it does feel like it's going to happen. They have the plans in place. They moved it all to Indiana. There is going to be some sort of a fan presence. Like, it's actually happening. And I feel like for a few months, maybe it was also hard to get into it, because you weren't sure you were going to make it.
Yeah. The other thing that's going to be weird is it's not the same schedule. Like
oh, yeah.
The games, mm-hmm. The Thursday, Friday, they're going to have games on Tuesdays, I think.
I think Mondays and Tuesdays for the Elite Eight. Yeah.
That's going to be a huge adjustment as well.
Yeah. And it'll
just be weird. In terms of feeling normal, it'll be a little bit different.
And obviously everyone's going to be, you know, concerned about the conference tournaments and making sure everyone comes out of those okay. You've already seen a couple of leagues switch some stuff around. The Big Ten moved their tournament to Indy. So their teams are basically just going to stay in the state of Indiana for a long time and maybe get some residency or something. But then also the Atlantic 10 flipped their tournaments so that the men will have a longer break before the NCAA tournament. So you're seeing people get pretty smart and get creative with this. And again, I think we're also starting to see kind of like the best teams, like the cream rise to the top. In your mind, you know, I know that, that we keep framing this conversation as like Gonzaga and Baylor and everybody else. In your mind, does Michigan have a chance to be in that top, top tier?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, they have to. I mean, there's no reason not to. You saw what they did and go to Ohio State and to win that game like they did. But they have, like, I think they have one loss on the season, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know they missed a lot of time.
They came out of the pause and have been playing great. Like, I don't, right. That can't be easy in general.
Right, right. And Dickinson is a great guy inside. They've, you know, what Juwan Howard is building there is looks like it's going to be really strong. The Big Ten as a whole, I mean, you know, the numbers say the Big Ten this year might be the best conference in, you know, KenPom history, behind right ahead of what, the 2004 ACC. I mean, you talk about Michigan, Ohio State, Illinois, Iowa, up and down that conference. Is crazy how good that league is. And for Michigan to be where they are with that record in that conference really speaks to just how good this team is.
And yet this is the conference that's got the national championship drought dating back to 2000.
It was Mark Titus who said on Twitter the other day, both Michigan and Ohio State looked like really strong teams to lose in the national championship game.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's really interesting, because I agree. I think, you know, you can't really argue with it being the best conference and the deepest. I was talking to John Beilein for Michigan Alumni Association conversation Zoom thing. And, you know, he made that point that, like, this is, like, the league has been so good and is so good this year. Like, these teams are good enough to break that drought. And I think it's what's really interesting, you know, as a Michigan alum and as someone who's covered the basketball program, they really are taking, like, the best parts about the Beilein era and the way that he built his teams. And then you have Juwan Howard, like, putting his touch on it. Like, clearly, the two transfers, when you take transfers and they've not really won and they were in the starting lineup and, like, you know, one of them's willing to come off the bench, like, these are dynamics and chemistry and puzzle pieces that are not easy and that really speak a lot to Juwan Howard himself and the way that his team is playing, like the poise down the stretch, all these things. It's really interesting because obviously he didn't take over and like the cupboard was bare when Beilein left, but you can already see like the foundation and then his own handprints on this particular team. And I think that's why people are talking about Juwan Howard as a National Coach of the Year candidate.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's not like he's just winning this game just with John Beilein's players. I mean, not at all. He's brought in a number of guys on his own who are key aspects to this. So, you know, Baylor Gonzaga. You know, we didn't get that game we were hoping to back in the offseason, or I mean, in the not conference season. I guess, you know, they are the clear top two teams, but you know, they have history in the NCAA tournament where there's reason to feel like this could be a wide open tournament, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, not knowing, you know, how teams are going to be playing coming off of breaks, like, you know, Baylor having a really late pause, like that's, I mean, it was going to be a really interesting stretch of their season where we were going to learn a lot about them, and they didn't get those games, right? And so, and then, you know, obviously you have the Gonzaga issue that you have pretty much every year where, like, they're not facing the level of competition that everyone else is for those 3 months leading into the tournament. What does that mean for the program? So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it all shakes out. Again, we're under 3 weeks away from Selection Sunday. Power Hour will be diving more into basketball as we get closer, go through conference tournaments and March Madness as well. So Chris, don't worry. I will not be bugging you about basketball all the time, even though I do know it's a hobby. You are a Michigan State grad, so it is in your blood somewhere.
Yeah, it's been a tough basketball season for Michigan State, no doubt. That's the other thing about college basketball. You know, Duke, North Carolina, Kentucky, Michigan State, like all being not good to average is kind of crazy. They might all miss the tournament of all years. That's a whole other, you know, thing going on in college basketball is all these blue bloods that aren't
Living up to it. And in all the theories related to that, right? About the weird season and how you don't have time to gel and bond and all these things. So absolutely tons of storylines to keep an eye on. It really does feel like it's starting to heat up finally. And again, we'll have more coverage of the college basketball season as we continue on with Power Hour. So, Chris, before we go, we have to do our last calls because that is our shtick here. And so, for our listeners who aren't familiar, you either rant or rave about something, whatever you might be feeling at the end of the night at a bar in normal times when you have a last call to something. Chris, would you like to go first?
Yes. Tip your cap, raise your glass, whatever you do, to Tarleton State football, which 2 years ago, 2019, this was a Division II team. It has moved up to FCS for 2020. It's playing a spring season. And in their first ever FCS game, they should have beaten McNeese State. They blew a lead at the end, lost in double overtime. Still a strong performance by Tarleton State. And then on Sunday, this past Sunday, they beat FBS New Mexico State 43-17. Now, New Mexico State is the only FBS team playing in the spring. They hadn't played a game in 450 days. They hadn't practiced in almost 400 days. And they're treating these games like a scrimmage. But you don't lose that game 43-17 if you're not, when you're an FBS team. Again, this FBS team against what was just recently a Division II team. That's two levels between them. Tarleton State is now 1-1 since the move up to FCS. They already have a win against an FBS team. They were a really strong Division II team when they made the move up. So shout out to Tarleton State football for a huge win over New Mexico State on Sunday.
My last call is also a cheers and a little bit of a roast. I was debating where to go with this, but we started the show talking about Deion Sanders, and I feel like it only makes sense to close it out with a cheers to our colleague and regular on this podcast feed, Ari Wasserman, who tried valiantly, so did Chris, to get Deion Sanders for any story since he's been hired about becoming a head coach at Jackson State. Ari goes through the Frito-Lay's route during the Super Bowl to get to an interview with Deion, where Deion stays on brand the entire time, compares recruits to potato chips. And Ari wrote one of the great intro sections to any story I've ever read from like an interview that was arranged through a brand, talking about Deion comparing players and his upbringing and his experience to potato chips. It was a piece of art. I thought it was remarkable. I think that I really would have loved, with all the chaos that happened over the weekend and the, misinformation and the conflicting statements, I would have really liked to hear what potato chips were, most like the situation.
Maybe some were stolen.
If Frito had a comment about it. Yeah. What were chips harmed in this situation? I don't know. But I would like to give a special shout out to Ari and Frito-Lays in general, because I just thought that it was a masterful way to get around and get to a subject. And then to also call them out for doing an interview through Frito-Lay. So shout out to Ari Wasserman, who will be on this podcast later this week, as always, with Andy Staples. So you can, whatever chaos, whatever crazy countdowns, rankings, food, I don't even know what they're going to do the rest of this week. But be sure to hang out on this feed, Andy Staples and Friends feed. And then we'll be back next Tuesday for more Power Hour. For Chris Vanini, I'm Nicole Auerbach. Thanks for hanging out with us.